This is Heather Johnson, and you're listening to the Ayurveda Life School podcast, episode number 143, Heart Medicine with Radhuli Weininger. This podcast is for people who want to take their health physically, emotionally, and spiritually to a whole new level using Ayurvedic medicine, the ancient healing tradition from India. This is the Ayurveda Life School podcast, and I'm your host, Heather Johnson. Welcome to the podcast today. I am so excited to have a special guest with us today. And lately, I feel like we have just been blessed with the best minds and in this thought process of really how do we find out who we truly are. And I think we're going to be blessed today. So I want to introduce to you today, we have Radhuli Weininger. Radhuli is a clinical psychologist, a psychotherapist, and a teacher of Buddhist medicine and Buddhist psychology. She's the co-founder and a guiding teacher of the nonprofit Mindful Heart Programs, which you guys will get to learn about a little bit today. And she works out of the Santa Barbara area as a full-time psychotherapist, as well as all of the other things that she's up to, which we'll get to learn about. But what's beautiful is the complement that she brings to Western medicine with Buddhist psychology and a lot of the meditation and mindfulness that we'll learn about. What I found interesting is that you've got an ongoing dream group, which I hope we bring up and talk about, as well as teaching a lot of seminars, half day, weekend, week-long retreats. And I'm interested to see how that's going with COVID and how that's affected that as well. Mm-hmm. But she's the author of two books, Heartwork, The Path of Self-Compassion, and her newest book that we'll dive into a little bit today, Heart Medicine, How to Stop Painful Patterns and Find Peace and Freedom at Last. I feel like that title just says it all. So I think we're in for a real treat today. So welcome to the podcast today.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, I'm excited to have you on because I feel like you bring a different perspective than maybe what my listeners are used to, because before we started recording, we were chatting a little bit about Ayurveda and your experience of having lived in India. But as far as your background, it's more from like a Buddhist background where your mindfulness and meditation practice began. But I kind of wanted to even rewind because I was really intrigued by your actual story of how you came first off to live in California, but also just your background and the things that kind of have shaped who you are now and why you are really coming from a place of working through your own lerps. We'll learn what lerps are here in a moment, but to help us then work through them as well. So I want a little background for everybody about where you come from, that kind of story.
Mm-hmm. So I'm coming maybe from the cultural landscape of post-war Germany. And I was born 1957 in Germany, and I was the illegitimate kid in the Catholic family, so which wasn't easy. My mother was a doctor, so I hardly ever saw her. And and so I think in that rather difficult climate, you know, of it was a refugee family from Eastern Europe. I think I had to start pulling myself out of the mud. Mm-hmm. And it came, I actually went through medical school in Germany. I even finished, believe it or not. And then when I came to the States, I got my PhD in clinical psychology. And it came to a halt when I had two car accidents in my early 20s and a stomach mm-hmm. ulcer. And it just really kind of, medicine was hard for me. I wasn't the born scientist. And so I think family problems, medicine all came together, being kind of a bit of an existentially worried young person. You know, mm-hmm. being a post-war German in this very difficult country where we just killed so many millions of people, it brought up a lot of existential problems for me. Yeah. And so I ended up in a monastery in Sri Lanka, actually really to study acupuncture there. That's why really? I went to Sri Lanka. Yeah, lots of German and European medical folks went over there to study acupuncture in the main Kalubovila General Hospital in Colombo. But then I kind of found my way to this really old monk who was just amazing. I just basically fell into him, ran into him, and had a real experience, you might say, of what do you call that? Shaktipat or something, you know, like a real kind of a spiritual experience. And then I thought, wow, this is what I want, peace and freedom. You know, I just felt it suddenly so strongly in my body. And then I found a monastery somewhere out in the countryside of Sri Lanka. And I stayed there for a few months until our visa ran out. But I got really established with a good meditation practice. And maybe because, what is that, Janis Joplin, freedom is just another word for having nothing left to lose.
So I love that. I love that you can bring in Janis Joplin. This is great.
So I was just really open. You know, I was open to, my ego wasn't important anymore. You know, it's like I was wide open to the new. You know, I didn't really have anything to defend or protect or whatever. It's just, okay, good riddance. Let's start new, right? And so sometimes I say I was born in Sri Lanka. But then, you know, I was thinking, you're an Ayurvedic school. I actually, because I was a German medical student, I was also interested in Ayurveda and just read a bit about it. And actually I went to a few Ayurvedic clinics. And then I ended up in a ashram in the Himalayas with a really wild guru, very small. You had to walk 8 hours through rivers with a guide to actually, it was very hard to find, you know, so it's sort of hard to find, very, get up at 3 in the morning, bathe in the Ganges in February, and Arati mornings and evenings and fire ceremonies and carry stones during the day. It was a trippy, wonderful experience. And I had already my meditation practice, which I think helped me. You know, I did everything in the ashram, the Hindu path. It was a Harakan Babaji was the teacher there, and it was a Shiva ashram. Mm-hmm. And but I did both. You know, I had my meditation practice, my mindfulness practice, compassion practice, and I, you know, so for me there was no dichotomy. You know, that wasn't. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm a true interfaith person. You know, it's like I love to go to Native American sweat lodges. You know, it's like.
I think they're fantastic. I've done some down in Mexico, so more of that Spanish style and Mexican style. And I love that. I feel like we were talking about this, there's interconnected truth that you find as you reach out to different, you know, different faiths, different disciplines that all bring you back to that same goal, which is finding, you know, who you truly are underneath all of that wounds and trauma. I know you talk about that a bit, but it's that core that's so similar, right? The core of who I am is so similar to the core of who you are, because it's really one and the same in that way.
It's what do you call it? Atman, Brahman.
Yes, exactly.
Right. or the field of awareness, whatever you want to call it, or God, or whatever name you give it, right? Is that be still and know that I am God? Is that
It's from the Bible. And I've always looked at that and thought, be still and know that I am God. And it's not talking about something outside of us. It's actually reminding you that I am. And when you say it to yourself, that I am. So it's that connection to spirit. That's how I interpret that.
I might go a little bit beyond that. And I say the I is not the personal I. Mm-hmm. It's the universal I. So it's everywhere.
Mm-hmm. You know, so it's not,
it's not skin enclosed, you know, it is, it's tapping into what's already there. Mm-hmm. And maybe that would say, you know, I have Jack Kornfield as my mentor for 20 years about, and knew him much longer. And I have gone the insight meditation, mindfulness path. But I'm also really interested in the last 10 years or so in what I can learn from Tibetan Buddhism, which is in a way more similar to what you encounter in Advaita Vedanta, you know, the non-dual, you know, tapping into not just awareness as moment by moment, non-judgmental practice, which is really important, especially psychologically, it's very useful, but also tapping into something that is sacred, that's already there. And I find that including that in the practice really important.
When you're starting out on this journey, for some people, even being mindful in moments to moment is so challenging. Yeah. And my background being more of that yogic philosophy, I see with people their avoidance of that identification. And I loved that. I wanted to come around to that concept of LERPs, which you talk about in your book.
But I think
when you say LERPs, I'm sure people are spelling it in their mind differently than we're actually spelling it. So it actually is LRPP, but tell us a little bit about what that stands for and kind of how you came to that awareness, because I think it's a universal truth. I love what you taught. Yeah. I mean, I think it will make sense to people, but LERPs, what does that stand for?
So LERPs are standing for longstanding recurrent painful patterns. And I was talking with Jack Kornfield, my mentor, for many years about this, because I certainly have my LERPs around abandonment, rejection, feeling left out, you know, kind of lack of a sense of belonging, you might say. And so, which then recreate themselves, you know, yes, maybe they come from my early childhood, my family, but then they come again and again, you know, whether it's in high school, whether it's now with maybe within spiritual groups, sometimes we feel criticized and left out. And so, and I just felt very raw about it. You know, I felt others maybe I can let it run off easily, but I wasn't. You know, for me, it makes me feel sick and quite depressed. And so I felt like a sitting duck to my LERPs. And so,
I love that visual. Do you think do you think that people respond to it differently because they've learned coping mechanisms that aren't necessarily healthy, where they're ignoring those sensations or those feelings?
Well, I think people think, oh, this is just so-and-so's fault. You know, this is just in the moment, or they are hating me and they are bad or whatever, you know. So in a way, we are externalizing, I might say, as a psychologist. And we think it's only in the moment and it's purely incidental that this happens again and again and again. And often you have to look from the outside and say, whoa, there's a pattern here. And you are actually meeting a similar story, just with different actors. And but often people don't see that in themselves, you know, because you have to step back a little bit. And, you know, it's like one of the chapters in the foundation part of the book is awareness, the medicine of awareness. You know, become aware, oh, this is happening, and to identify it.
You defined a word, awareing. Can I read what you said? Because I loved it. Because it's that idea of being able to identify or find that space outside to notice. But you said in the book, awareing is applying moment-to-moment awareness with a non-judgmental attitude to whatever we are experiencing in each instant. And I think there's so much in that, because first, the having moment-to-moment awareness is difficult because it requires a space between the external environment and what's happening and our response.
Yeah.
Right? And judging how you're responding or what is coming up for you actually brings you deeper into that LERP, I believe, because then you're not just feeling the emotion, then there's judgment about feeling the emotion. So then you get kind of this mess in there. So I love that word awaring. I think we all need to just like put that on a t-shirt. I am awaring today. Like I'm doing this in this practice. So,
and you know, as you go to that, as we talk a little bit on what to do, you know, yes, awaring moment by moment with self-compassion. Because often then we blame ourselves. Why can't I get over it? Why am I not tougher? Why, whatever, you know, why was I in the wrong time, in the wrong place? So whatever it is. And then, you know, what I call then the skill of being mindful moment by moment, but then also what I call the mindful pause, which is, I think I have it here on my, on little cards, you know, how can I, you know, have a little practice during the day. You know, we always have a few minutes to go to the restroom or to get a glass of water, make a cup of tea, or I don't know, go to the mailbox or whatever we can do, right? And so to notice what's going on in our bodies, exhale to relax, recognize that we have been hurt. Extend compassion towards ourselves. Connect with the wider breath. And then notice when we are ready to re-engage. And then there's this other practice, which is a little longer, which is when triggered pause, I think, which is really looking at the steps of what's happening. Because one thing we don't want to do is just fall into rumination.
Exactly. And that is so hard. I feel like that's where we tend to go. We think, oh, well, then this happened or this happened. And then we just spin. And that's
then
I
we
think,
spin. Yes. Right.
It's my insomnia patients, they're spinning all night long. I'm like, oh, goodness.
So then coming, noticing what's going on, and then coming back to the felt sense of the body, the physical sensations in the body. Let's say the mind is spinning. Oh, what happened yesterday? What did I do wrong? What did they do wrong? What could have happened? And all of that. And then to notice, where do I feel that in my body? Yes, I feel that like a tightness in the heart or a knot in the stomach. And to stay with that, because then we bring it into the present moment. And only in the present moment can change happen.
So when we're looking at these LERPs, you mentioned that trauma is at the core, right? There's always something that was traumatic. And I think what is trauma for one person isn't always what's trauma for another person. And that's what's so interesting about human beings and the way we function in the world is that our ability, or some people say resilience, is very different, but it's just what is hard for us and what draws us back to those traumatic moments. Do you ever get to a place where you feel like you are truly letting go of those, or are they things that you get triggered again, you work through the steps, and maybe it's not as intense as you continue to work forward? What have you found? Because I see this, right? I have clients that have been having the same, they're just living the same day that they've been living for the last 40 years because they're stuck on something and they can't figure out why things aren't improving and why they don't have progress, or they'll read old journals and they're complaining and upset about the same things today that they were 20 years ago. There's not been forward progress going on. So what do we say for these folks? Because sometimes that's me, and I know that's a hard place. You want to be able to move past that, but do you ever really move past it, or do you just learn how to come back to this moment again and again?
Well, I think both. You know, it's definitely a bit of a lengthy process, the healing process, and I might compare that to a physical ailment. Let's say if our leg was injured years ago and it's stiff, it definitely takes quite a bit of physical therapy and and healing to slowly bend it back into how it should be, or maybe to talk with neuroplasticity for new neural pathways to develop takes time. You know, it's not like taking an aspirin and here we are. But I think, so it's definitely a bit of a lengthy process. But I think one thing we learn is that the LERP is not sitting in the front seat of the car anymore, but maybe in the back seat. You know, it might be still grumbling a little bit in the back seat, but it's not anymore having the steering wheel. Maybe first it becomes the passenger, who says, and then we put it in the back seat and maybe later into the trailer.
I love that. Do you think you can equate it a little bit to the way we work with ego versus higher self? Because the ego is always there, but we get to a place where we can say, thank you for your input, but I'm going to act from this space, from this place of compassion or higher self. Cause that's how I view the ego is sometimes you're letting it drive the boat, right? And you're making all these decisions based upon the desires and kind of that base level versus moving beyond to who I believe you truly are, which is that higher space of consciousness. So is that feels similar to what you just said?
It does. However, I think it's important that we don't do what we might call a spiritual bypass, where we just kind of zoom off into the higher self without really taking care of all the other parts. You know, sometimes we could use those kinds of philosophies as an kind of an escape and a bypass. So usually we really have to feel what we feel and to go through compassion and forgiveness and, you know, but the higher self certainly helps.
When I think when it's interesting, when I'm teaching yoga practice, if we're doing a more difficult practice, I'll see people try to check out mentally. We'll be in a pose maybe that's challenging and their body is feeling it and they don't want to feel it because it's hurting or there's muscle use that they're not used to. And so you can almost feel them check out, right? And they'll maybe go so deep into their breath that they're almost hypnotizing themselves away from feeling what they're going through in the class. And so that's something that I find people often come to yoga because they want to find that self-awareness. But even in that space where they're working towards being aware in the moment, they find ways to escape it. And so coming back to it again and again and reminding yourself that I'm going to feel what I'm feeling and go through what I'm going through and it's okay. Or I see people that will eat in order to avoid emotion or overly watch TV or things like that. So they find ways to escape from it. But the practice is simple, right? It feels like there's simple things that we can do to kind of come back to it. You share a ton of them in the book. I mean, heart medicine's got so many.
Yeah. You know, when you speak to that, I'm kind of reminded a little bit of post-traumatic stress symptoms, PTSD, which probably you know about, you know, and part of them are dissociation, avoidance. And some of that, there isn't conscious and an unconscious. You know, it's not all just readily under our conscious control.
Yeah.
So I guess it's more about noticing, being compassionate with ourselves, and then bringing ourselves back very gently. That is important, you know, because otherwise we become antagonistic with ourselves.
That judgment that we talked about. Well, and you have in the book, you talk about 12 steps about working through these LERPs, but they're not sequential necessarily, correct?
No, you can mix and match. And for example, the mystery, the chapter about the mystery, I wanted to have it much earlier, but my editors wanted to have it late. You know? Start with the practical, literal, and then go to the metaphysical, but I honestly feel sometimes it's good to have it right also close to the beginning. So whatever you find is good for you. there's no real order. Even though maybe recognizing the lerp, noticing when I feel tight in my heart or a knot in the stomach, it's good to do that fairly early on. Mm-hmm. And maybe to have some basic mindfulness, noticing, coming back to the felt sense practice is also a good thing. Yeah. But otherwise, use it intuitively.
So, and that's what I was going to ask. I know for many, if they're not feeling in touch with themselves yet, knowing how to start is tricky. Journaling was something that you talked about really early on when you're identifying how mm-hmm. lerps come up for you, because there's a lot of different symptoms or things that you might experience, but maybe not everyone experiences all of those things, right? Maybe not every person is having as much exaggerated body symptoms, but they instead are more in the mind and ruminating on thoughts.
Right.
So journaling itself, where do you see that as a role? Is that a useful thing for someone to be doing on a regular basis? I mean, I mentioned that client that is still journaling the same ruminating thoughts over 20 years. So is that still a useful practice for us to be doing, especially at the beginning when we're trying to get more clarity on what we're experiencing?
Well, you know, maybe it's dependent on how we journal. You know, if we journal more stream of mind and also journal about how we feel in our bodies, mm-hmm. that helps. But if it's more about, becomes like a rumination exercise, then it just makes the groove deeper.
And you said that, let's, samskaras, when you say groove, my mind immediately goes to samskaras. And I think mm-hmm. that's because of some of my meditation training, but also just because of samskaras. Yeah. But that is a topic that sometimes is confusing for people. When you mention it in relationship to these lerps, these mm-hmm. you know, longstanding patterns, how do we work with them from that frame of mind? Because I know for my listeners, some of them are going to be more familiar with that idea.
Okay. You know, so the question is, of how do these lerps come about? You know, mm-hmm. yes, when I talk, Jung and Freud call them complexes or psychoids. And so then we think more of early childhood, you know, that mm-hmm. something happened. Then, you know, nowadays there is this new term, transgenerational trauma, that actually trauma that's passed down in our family tree. See that often, you know, I worked with women who were sexually abused. Often you see it's three generations back, you know, going down again and again. And they found now that it changes a little bit the methylation on our genes. So there's a little bit of a change, you know, and so it's, I don't know what it means, if it's a habit or if it's really something on our genes, who knows, but we can definitely heal it. And samskaras, the ideas, in Pali, it's called shankaras. It's, sorry, it's that there are patterns in our mind stream that are passed down through lifetimes. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly possible. Yeah. You know, I remember doing once with Jack Kornfield, he did with me a past life regression. And there I was, you know, with my lerp. And so I think that's, you know, if that kind of understanding helps you, let's say they're old. We don't know quite how old, but they're very old. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really matter that much, you know, if they are from our childhood or transgenerational or from past lifetimes. We are here now having to deal with them. Yeah. So I wouldn't even kind of ruminate too much, you know, how many lifetimes ago that was. It's more like, yes, they're really old and they feel old in our bodies. And now we want to find freedom.
Well, and I think you're right, because that just pulls you into rumination about, well, the why. And having done, you know, psychotherapy in the past, or it's interesting how different practitioners work differently. And there's been some that I feel like all we did was ruminate and I didn't feel a lot of progress happening. And then somewhere the story was interesting a little, just to help see where I'm at today. And then let's move forward. Let's actually take some steps to heal and to see improvement and not spend 20 years writing in our journal about the same thing. And so I think that's what you said with the grooves. We just get kind of in this rut way of thinking, and stressors come. And I see this Ayurvedically with the doshas, how different doshas will respond to stress differently. And for us, it's kind of, that's your natural way of responding to stress, but that doesn't mean that's how you have to respond to stress, right? You don't have to get angry every time and explode on everyone just because you have a lot of fire within you. You can actually choose to pause, feel what you're feeling, and try to identify, am I actually angry at what's going on here? Or is this because there's a pattern that I've not dealt with? And for me, that's what I find, because I tend to, anger is my first response when under stress. And so I try to look, and am I repressing anger? Am I not fully seeing where it's coming from? Can I just feel it right now and not choose to lash out or eat? Because that's something that I have noticed for me. When I feel anger, I want to eat something. It's like, I want to stop the feeling. And so recognizing that space has been really helpful. Mm-hmm. And then taking a moment to be kind of compassionate towards not just myself. And you shared this in the book, that really that final step of healing is turning all of this outward, and self-compassion to me, and then compassion and love externally, really stepping into service.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you know, with the anger, it might still be important to notice what maybe helpful role that anger might have played as you were growing up. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it helps to stop something.
That's true.
Some abuse. And so, you know, anger is activating and organizing. And so to have compassion for that, but then move on.
Yeah. And giving acknowledgement. I think with COVID, it was really interesting because the emotions were so deeply felt by so many, because the busyness and all the external stimulus was withdrawn. And I think that's why we saw such an increase in mental health problems and anger and depression, because these lerps that we've never really faced, because we managed to stay kind of, I don't know, it's all under the water and we were up above treading water and not paying attention and listening to them, came to the surface. Did you see that? I would imagine your clientele probably either really shifted in what they needed to have work on, or it grew because people were really struggling during that time and still are really.
Yeah. And you know, actually I'm writing now monthly a blog for Psychology Today. Oh. And at Christmas, I wrote one on how the holidays and COVID can trigger our old lerps. You know, because there is suddenly this different expectation, or, you know, with COVID, suddenly we lose our community, or there is a lack of belonging, or we have more existential fears about money, or, you know, there's less safety, there's the uncertainty.
Yeah.
You know, if you take COVID, climate change, and cultural divergence, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty around. And I think that can trigger, you know, bad families from our childhood, you know, where there was no safety and too much uncertainty and maybe even danger. And so, yes, these lerps come out big time right now.
And as you're saying all of that, from an Ayurvedic viewpoint, it's this increase of movement, right? There's a lack of grounding, a lack of stability, an increase of movement, the uncertainty, and the core feeling that often comes up beneath all of that is fear.
Because yeah.
It's that fear of the unknown, fear of what's going to happen next. Like you said, that existential experience with things like finances or just where you're going. And even that belief of, you know, people around me that I love are dying. What does that mean? I've never faced this before. I've never really thought what's going to happen at that point because it's not something that was in my space. So I think it's really brought up a lot. Do you feel like that's actually in some ways, not that we're, I can't say yet that I'm grateful for COVID. Maybe I'll get to a space where I can have more of a bigger view, but also that it's allowed people to maybe think and feel and work through things that they wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it could either make people shut down and maybe just indulge some addiction or tune out, or it can make us wiser and take the opportunity to look at ourselves and our world and, you know, and heal and make our world a better place. So certainly there's an opportunity in it.
Yeah. As there is with everything, right? That's why we, I think, go through experiences that we have is to grow and learn, evolve, become more connected, and ultimately to love and serve in a bigger and higher way. So,
yeah.
So your work that you do with your Mindful Heart programs, I wanted to have you tell me more about that because for those of you listening, I took some time to go and peruse Redwood's website. Oh my goodness. So many offerings, so many beautiful things, but I wanted to know, how did this program come about? How did you create this Mindful Heart?
Well, I was teaching at a local retreat center, La Casa de Maria, which was a beautiful, big retreat center owned by some ex-Catholic Franciscan nuns who had become too liberal in the 70s and had their own place then, and very interfaith. And then that retreat center basically fell down the mountain with the mudslide. It was destroyed.
Oh, how sad. That's tragic.
Yeah. And so I gave a facilitator training there, mindfulness and compassion facilitator training, weekly groups, weekend groups, sometimes week-long groups. And so that's still a big... So that's when we said, okay, we start this nonprofit to maybe get scholarships for people who want to take our facilitator trainings. Our classes are free, but, you know, retreats. And from there it developed. And then with the mudslide also, what happened is that we realized that a lot of children were really upset and young people. Mm-hmm. And right now we have this big mental health crisis of young people. And so I went to Santa Barbara High School with actually one of my interns. And from there, some people said, you know, we want to go into schools. And one woman who has a PhD in cognitive neuroscience said, okay, I want to develop this program. And I said, okay, we have already this nonprofit. And so this became a big school program here in Santa Barbara. Wow. And going into more and more public schools and, you know, all that's connected with doing that. And then we have when COVID started, my adult sons helped me to start very swiftly in March 20, this online platform.
Oh.
And, you know, I was teaching in different places in town. And so suddenly we were online. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to do weekend retreats very much right now because all the retreat centers either closed down or fell off the mountain or COVID hit. So we have to begin that again. But right now, what seems really helpful for people is our first meditation starts 7:30 to 8 in the morning. It's just lightly guided, no teaching or, you know, discussion, just a half hour. And then at, from 10 to 11, many people who are older like that, because, you know, they don't want to get up that early. And then we have evening at 7, which would be 8 o'clock your time, I think Monday through Thursday. And then Mondays, midday, we have mindful self-compassion with Hattie. And Sunday mornings, my husband, who's a hospice palliative care doctor, and I lead a group, probably our biggest group, on self-care, mindfulness, and self-care, and how to be with fear in daunting times. A lot of people from Europe come to that. So, yeah, people can just... And, you know, you talked about dreams. I want to start. I had for 10 years a dream group, which unfortunately is not going on anymore. Embodied imagination, which is a very body-focused, phenomenological, going really into the images on how they feel and letting the wisdom of the images arise by themselves. And so that was a wonderful group. And I'm just thinking about starting it again, maybe online. So that's something I'm planning right now for the spring.
So that is a lot that you have going on. So you mentioned like interns or people can take courses. So we've got the opportunity for people to come on and do meditations with your group. And you mentioned those. There's actually a calendar, and I'll put that link in the show notes so everyone can find the link right to that so they can see it. But do you teach people to be facilitators of this Mindful Heart program then?
Well, you know, I do two things. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist, and I have some people who get their 3,000 hours through me, you know, to become licensed MFTs or psychologists. So I do that just a little bit. And those people are mainly some who are already teaching also mindfulness and work in the schools, or, you know, so they help me. But we also will have again in April, most likely, a mindfulness and compassion facilitator program. So we are just planning that and setting that up. And it probably will be hybrid. Maybe we'll meet maybe one or two times in person, and then also meet online. So we'll see how we do that in this day and age.
Would that be a program for people who are already in the psychotherapy field, or would it be a program, you know, if I have a yoga teacher somewhere that wants to learn more about that, they could get involved too? Okay, good.
Yeah. Yeah. We had in our last facilitator program, which was now 3 years ago, several yoga teachers and who are now teaching at the local yoga center. And actually I'm teaching at the local yoga center. They have a yoga soup. They're a great place. And so they are very interested in making this bridge between mindfulness and yoga.
Well, I love that, because I know I have a lot of listeners that are in that space, so they can get involved. So all of you, it's mindfulheartprograms.org for that information. But I feel like we have just been so blessed. Heart medicine, you mostly wrote during COVID. Is that correct? Like during
No, I started it before, really, because with Shambhala, which is my publisher, you have to give it in a year early, and then there's the last editing. So basically, it was mainly written when COVID started.
Got it. Okay. But I feel like the timing is not coincidental, because of what we've There was higher forces at work with you putting that piece out right when it came out. So, and I'll put links so that everybody can find where they can purchase that. I mean, it's pretty much everywhere. I mean, you can find it on Amazon and from your website and lots of other publishers as well. But is there anything else that you want people to know about your work or what your intention is with what you do, just so that they can kind of, you know, really understand how they can be involved with you or just support what you're up to?
Well, I have a pretty full psychotherapy practice, so I don't have a whole lot of space. But, you know, I see people from different parts of the country in my private psychotherapy practice. in which I bring all of this together. And my email is radley@gmail.com. So
perfect.
If there's interest, and again, I have to say, I don't have a huge amount of time, but maybe I could make for people who are really interested, especially yogis. I love to work with people who also have a spiritual practice. So that's another thing I'm doing. And I'm thinking about starting maybe a few groups, again, a dream group. And I'm teaching one class through Inside LA, together with Inside LA, which is heart medicine, how to work with LERPS, with longstanding painful patterns. And that's once a month. And I think it's mentioned on our website.
Okay.
But you sign up through Inside LA, and it's once a month, a seminar.
And I noticed you do have a place on their website. You can sign up for a newsletter. So if they sign up there, they'll find out all the things. So just do that, and then you'll know all the things that are happening that you can get involved with. But it's been such a pleasure to have you on today. Thank you so much for taking the time to share with me and the listeners what you've worked decades to create and to share who you are with us.
Well, you've been a wonderful interviewer. Thank you so much. And good luck with your own creation.
Thank you. That's always fun and busy, right? We're always creating, sharing, and growing. So beautiful. Well, thanks so much for having you on with us today.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Before you go, was this episode helpful for you? Well, the most helpful thing you can do in return is to leave a review in iTunes. The reviews are what keep the podcast going. And be sure to subscribe and share this episode if you loved it. You can connect with me online at AyurvedaLifeSchool.com, on Instagram, and on Facebook at Ayurveda Life School. Have a beautiful day. Namaste.